suspects. We have to fix the boy. A wave of emotion and confusion washed over Holzer, and once again he saw before him that empty, glassy look from the double bed which had made him so uncomfortable. "The hell I will," he said, without really believing it. "I know you got problems with children. I don't like it either. But we can't avoid this one. Besides, you should be grateful. Kira could just as easily have sacrificed you."
"I suppose so. Then it's settled. I've got the plane tickets in my pocket. We'll take the first flight in the morning to Arlanda at 6:30, and then we're going to some place on Sveavägen called Odens Medical Center for Children and Adolescents."
"So the boy's in a clinic?"
"Yes, and that's why we need to do some planning. Let me just finish eating."
The man who called himself Jan Holzer closed his eyes and tried to figure out what he was going to say to Olga. Zalander was up at 5 the next morning and hacked into the NSF, Major Research Instrumentation supercomputer at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. She needed all the mathematical skills she could muster. Then she got out her own program for elliptic curve factorization and set about cracking the file she had downloaded from the NSA. But however hard she tried, she could not manage it. She had not really been expecting to do so. It was a sophisticated RSA encryption, named after the originators Rivest, Shamir, and Adelman. RSA has two keys, one public, one secret, and is based on Euler's Phi function and Fermat's little theorem, but above all on the simple fact that it is easy to multiply two large prime numbers. A calculator will give you the answer in the blink of an eye, yet it is all but impossible to work backwards, and on the basis of the answer, calculate the prime numbers you started out with. Computers are not yet efficient at prime number factorization, something which had exasperated Lisbeth Zalander and the world's intelligence organizations many times in the past. For about a year now, Zalander had been thinking that ECM, the elliptic curve method, would be more promising than previous algorithms, and she had spent long nights writing her own factorization program. But now, in the early hours of the morning, she realized it would need more refinement to have even the slightest chance of success. After 3 hours of work, she took a break and went to the kitchen, drank some orange juice straight from the carton, and ate two microwaved piroshki. Back at her desk, she hacked into Blomqvist's computer to see if he'd come up with anything new. He had posted two more questions for her, and she realized he wasn't so hopeless after all. "Which of Franz Walder's assistants betrayed him?" he wrote, which was a reasonable question. She did not answer. She could not care less about Arvid Wrange. But she had made progress and worked out who the hollow-eyed junkie was, the man Wrange had been in touch with, who had called himself Bogey. Trinity in Hacker Republic remembered somebody with that same handle from a number of hacker sites some years previously. That did not necessarily mean anything. Bogey was not the most original alias. But Zalander had traced the posts and thought she could be onto something, especially when he carelessly dropped that he was a computer engineer from Moscow University. Zalander was unable to find out when he graduated, or any other dates, for that matter, but she got hold of a couple of nerdy details about how Bogey was hooked on fine watches and crazy for the Arsène Lupin films from the 70s, about the gentleman thief of that name. Then Zalander posted questions on every conceivable website for former and current students at Moscow University, asking if anybody knew a scrawny, hollow-eyed ex-junkie who had been a street urchin and master thief and loved Arsène Lupin films. It was not long before she got a reply. "That sounds like Yuri Bogdanov," wrote someone, who introduced herself as Galina. According to this Galina, Bogdanov was a legend at the university, not just because he had hacked into all the lecturers' computers and had dirt on every one of them. He liked to ask people, "Will you bet me 100 rubles I can't break into that house over there?" Many who did not know him thought this was easy money, but Yuri could pick any door lock, and if for some reason he failed, then he would shin up the facade or the walls. He was known for his daring, and for his evil. He was said once to have kicked a dog to death when it disturbed him in his work, and he was always stealing things, just for the hell of it. Galina thought he might have been a kleptomaniac. But he was also a genius hacker and a talented analyst, and after he graduated the world was his oyster. He did not want a job, he wanted to go his own way, he said, and it did not take Salander long to work out what he got up to after university, at least according to the official version. Yuri Bogdanov was now 34 years old. He had left Russia and lived in Berlin at Budapester Strasse 8, not far from the Michelin-starred restaurant Hugo's. He ran a white hat computer security business, Outcast Security, with 7 employees and a turnover in the last financial year of 22 million euros. It was ironic, yet somehow entirely logical, that his front was a company which protected industrial groups from people like himself. He had not had any criminal convictions since he took his exams and managed a wide network of contacts. One of the members of his board of directors was Ivan Gribanov, member of the Russian Duma and a major shareholder in the oil company Gazprom. But she could find nothing to get her further. Blomqvist's second question was, Odin's medical center on Sveavägen, is it safe? Delete this as soon as you read it. He did not explain why he was interested in the place, but she knew that Blomqvist was not someone who threw questions out at random, nor did he make a habit of being unclear. If he was being cryptic, then he had a reason to be, and the information must be sensitive. There was evidently something significant about this medical center. Salander soon discovered that it had attracted a number of complaints. Children had been forgotten, or ignored, and had been able to self-harm. Odin's was managed privately by its director, Torkel Linden, and his company, Care Me. And, if one was to believe past employees, Linden's word was law. The profit margin was always high, because nothing was bought unless absolutely necessary. Linden himself was a former star gymnast, among other things, a one-time Swedish horizontal bar champion. Nowadays he was a passionate hunter and member of a Christian congregation that took an uncompromising line on homosexuality. Salander went onto the websites of the Swedish Association for Hunting and Wildlife Management and the Friends of Christ to see what kinds of tempting activities were going on there. Then she sent Linden 2 fake but enticing emails which looked as if they had come from the organizations. Attached were PDF files with sophisticated malware, which would open automatically if Linden clicked on the messages. By 8:23 she had gotten onto the server, and immediately confirmed her suspicions. August Balder had been admitted to the clinic the previous afternoon. In the medical file, underneath a description of the circumstances which had resulted in his admittance, it said, "Infantile autism, severe mental impairment, restless, severely traumatized by death of father, constant observation required, difficult to handle, brought jigsaw puzzles, not allowed to draw, observed to be compulsive and destructive, diagnosis by psychologist Forsberry, confirmed by T.L." And the following had been added underneath, clearly somewhat later. "Professor Charles Edelman, Chief Inspector Boblansky, and Detective Sergeant Modig will visit A. Balder at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, November 22nd. T.L. will be present. Drawing under supervision." Further down still, it said, "Change of venue. A. Balder to be taken by T.L. and Professor Edelman to his mother, Hannah Balder, on Torsgatan. Boblansky and Modig will join. A.B. is thought likely to draw better in his home environment." Salander quickly checked who Edelman was, and when she saw that his specialism was savant skills, she understood straight away what was going on. They seemed to be working towards some sort of testimony in the form of a sketch. Why else would Boblansky and Sonia Modig be interested in the boy's drawing? And why else would Blomqvist have been so cautious in framing his question? None of this must be allowed to get out. No killer must be able to find out that the boy might draw a picture of him. Salander decided to see for herself how careful Linden had been in his correspondence. Luckily he had not written anything more about the boy's drawing ability. He had, on the other hand, received an email from Edelman at 11:10 last night, copied to Modig and Boblansky. That email was clearly the reason why the meeting place had been changed. Edelman wrote, "Hi, Torkel. How good of you to see me at your medical center. I really appreciate it, but I'm afraid I have to be a bit awkward. I think we stand the best chance of getting a good result if we arrange for the boy to draw in an environment where he feels secure. That's not in any way to criticize your medical center. I've heard a lot of good things about it. The hell you have, Solander thought, and read on, Therefore I'd like us to move the boy to his mother, Hanna Balder, on Torsgarten tomorrow morning. The reason being that it is recognized in literature on the subject that the presence of the mother has a positive effect on children with savant skills. If you and the boy can wait outside the entrance on Sverwegen at 9:15 a.m., then I can pick you up as I go by. That would give us the opportunity for a bit of a chat between colleagues. Best regards, Charles Edelman. Poblansky and Modic had replied at 7:01 and 7:14 a.m. respectively. There were good reasons, they wrote, to rely on Edelman's expertise and follow his advice. Linden had at 7:57 confirmed that he and the boy would await Charles Edelman outside the entrance on Sverwegen. Solander sat for a while, lost in thought. Then she went to the kitchen and picked up a few old biscuits from the larder, while she looked out towards Slusen and Riddarfjorden. So, she thought, the venue for the meeting has been changed. Instead of doing his drawing at the medical centre, the boy would be driven home to his mother. The presence of the mother has a positive effect, Edelman wrote. There was something about that phrase Solander did not like. It felt old-fashioned, didn't it? And the introduction itself was not much better, the reason being that it is recognized in literature on the subject. It was stilted. Although it was true that many academics could not write to save their lives, and she knew nothing about the way in which this professor normally expressed himself, would one of the world's leading neurologists really feel the need to lean on what is recognized in the literature? Wouldn't he be more self-assured? Solander went to her computer and skimmed through some of Edelman's papers online. She may have found the odd little touch of vanity, even in the most factual passages, but there was nothing clumsy or psychologically naive in what he had written. On the contrary, the man was sharp. So she went back to the emails and checked to find out which SMTP server it had been transmitted through, and that made her jump right away. The server, Berdino, was not familiar, which it should have been, so she sent it a series of commands to see exactly what it was. In a matter of seconds, she had the evidence in black and white. The server supported open mail relay, and the sender could therefore transmit messages from any address he wanted. In other words, the email from Edelman was a fake, and the copies to Poblansky and Murdig were a smokescreen. She hardly even needed to check. She already knew what had happened. The police replies and the approval of the altered arrangements were also a bluff. It didn't just mean that someone was pretending to be Edelman. There also had to be a leak, and above all, somebody wanted the boy outside on Sverwegen. Somebody wanted him defenseless in the street, so that... what? They could kidnap or get rid of him? Solander looked at her watch. It was already 8:55. In just 20 minutes, Torkel Lindén and August Balder would be outside waiting for someone who was not Professor Edelman, and who had anything but good intentions towards them. What should she do? Call the police? That was never her first choice. She was especially reluctant when there was a risk of leaks. Instead, she went onto Odin's website and got hold of Lindén's office number, but she only made it as far as the switchboard. Lindén was in a meeting, so she found his mobile. After ending up in his voicemail, she swore out loud and sent him both a text and an email, telling him on no account to go out into the street with the boy, not under any circumstances. She signed herself Wasp, for lack of a better idea. Then she threw on her leather jacket and rushed out. After a second, she turned, ran back into the apartment, and packed her laptop with the encrypted file and her pistol, a Beretta 92, into a black sports bag. Then she hurried out again. She wondered if she should take her car, the BMW M6 convertible, gathering dust in the garage, but she decided a taxi would be quicker. She soon regretted it. When a taxi finally appeared, it was clear that rush hour had not subsided. Traffic inched forward and Centralbron was almost at a standstill. Had there been an accident? Everything went slowly, everything but the time, which flew. Soon it was 9:05, then 9:10. She was in a tearing hurry, and in the worst case it was already too late. Most likely Lindén and the boy went out onto the street ahead of time, and the killer, or whoever it was, had already struck. She dialed Lindén's number again. This time the call went through, but there was no answer, so she swore again and thought of Mikael Blomqvist. She had not actually spoken to him in ages, but now she called him, and he answered, sounding irritated. Only when he realized who it was did he brighten up.
"Lisbeth, is that you?"
"Shut up and listen," she said.
Blomqvist was in the Millennium offices on Jutgatan in a foul mood. It was not just because he had had another bad night. It was TT, usually a serious and decent news agency. TT had put out a bulletin claiming that Mikael Blomqvist was sabotaging the murder inquiry by withholding crucial information, which he intended to publish first in Millennium. Allegedly, his aim was to save the magazine from financial disaster and rebuild his own ruined reputation. Blomqvist had known that the story was in the offing. He had had a long conversation with its author, Harold Wallin, the evening before, but he could not have imagined such a devastating result. It was made up of idiotic insinuations and unsubstantiated accusations, but Wallin had nonetheless managed to produce something which sounded almost objective, almost credible. The man obviously had good sources both within the Cerna Group and the police. Admittedly, the headline was innocuous. Prosecutor critical of Mikael Blomqvist, and there was plenty of room in the story for Blomqvist to defend himself, but whichever one of his enemies was responsible understood media logic. If a news bureau as serious as TT publishes a story like this one, not only does that make it legitimate for everybody else to jump on the bandwagon, it just about requires them to take a tougher line. It explains why Blomqvist woke up to the online papers saying, "Blomqvist sabotages murder investigation," and "Blomqvist attempts to save magazine. Murderer runs free." The print media were good enough to put quotation marks around the headlines. But the overall impression was nevertheless that a new truth was being served up with a breakfast coffee. A columnist by the name of Gustav Lund, who claimed to be fed up with all the hypocrisy, began his piece by writing, "Mikael Blomqvist, who has always thought of himself as a cut above the rest, has now been unmasked as the biggest cynic of us all."
"Let's hope they don't start waving subpoenas at us," said Malm, designer and part owner of the magazine, as he stood next to Blomqvist, nervously chewing gum.
"Let's hope they don't call in the Marines," Blomqvist said.
"What?"
It was meant to be a joke.
"I get it. I don't like the tone," Malm said.
"Nobody likes it. But the best we can do is grit our teeth and keep working as usual."
"Your phone's buzzing."
"It's always buzzing.
How about answering it before they come up with anything worse?"
"Yes, yes," Blomqvist muttered, and answered gruffly.
It was a girl. He thought he recognized the voice, but caught off guard, he could not at first place it.
"Who's that?"
he said.
"Salander,"
said the voice. And at that he gave a big smile.
"Lisbeth, is that you?"
"Shut up and listen," she said.
And so he did. The traffic had eased, and Salander and the taxi driver, a young man from Iraq named Ahmed, who had lost his mother and two brothers in terrorist attacks, had emerged onto Sveavägen and passed the Stockholm Konserthuset on their left. Salander, who was a terrible passenger, sent off yet another text message to Linden and tried to call some other member of the staff at Odens, anybody who could run out and warn him. No reply. She swore aloud, hoping that Blomqvist would do better.
"Is it an emergency?" Ahmed said from the driver's seat.
When Salander replied, "Yes," Ahmed shot the light and got a fleeting smile out of her. After that she focused on every foot they covered. Away to the left she caught a glimpse of the School of Economics and the public library. It was not far to go now. She scanned for the street numbers on the right-hand side, and at last saw the address. Thankfully there was no one lying dead on the sidewalk. Salander pulled out some 100-kroner notes for Ahmed. It was an ordinary, dreary November day, no more than that, and people were on their way to work. But wait. She looked over towards the low, green-speckled wall on the other side of the street. A powerfully built man, in a woolen hat and dark glasses, was standing there, staring intently at the entrance on Sveavägen. There was something about his body language. His right hand was not visible, but the arm was tensed and ready. Salander looked again at the entrance to Odins, to the extent that she could see anything from her oblique angle, and she noticed the door opening. It opened slowly, as if the person about to come out were hesitant or finding the door heavy, and all of a sudden Salander shouted to Ahmed to stop. She jumped out of the moving car just as the man across the street raised his right hand and aimed a pistol with a telescopic sight at the door as it slid open.
Chapter 17 November 22nd
The man, who called himself Jan Holzer, was not happy with the situation. The place was wide open, and it was the wrong time of day. The street was too busy, and although he had done his best to cover his face, he was uncomfortable in daylight and so near the park. More than ever, he felt that he hated killing children. But that's the way it was, and he had to accept that the situation was of his own making. He had underestimated the boy, and now he had to correct his mistake. He must not let wishful thinking or his own demons get in the way. He would keep his mind on the job, be the professional he always was, and above all, not think about Olga, still less recall that glassy stare which had confronted him in Baldur's bedroom. He had to concentrate now on the doorway across the street, and on his Remington pistol, which he was keeping under his windbreaker. But why wasn't anything happening? His mouth felt dry. The wind was biting, there was snow lying in the street and on the sidewalk, and people were hurrying back and forth to work. He tightened his grip on the pistol and glanced at his watch. It was 9:16, and then 9:17. But still no one emerged from the doorway across the road, and he cursed. Was something wrong? All he had to go by was Bogdanov's word, but that was assurance enough. The man was a wizard with computers, and last night he had sat engrossed in his work, sending off fake emails and getting the language right with the help of his contacts in Sweden. Also had taken care of the rest, studying pictures of the place, selecting the weapon, and above all, organizing the getaway car, a rental which Dennis Vilton of the Slavershire Motorcycle Club had fixed for them under a false name, and which was now standing ready 3 blocks away, with Bogdanov at the wheel. Holzer sensed a movement immediately behind him and jumped. But it was just 2 young men walking past a little too close to him. The street seemed to be getting busier, and he did not like that. In the distance a dog was barking, and there was a smell, maybe food frying at McDonald's. Then, at long last, a short man in a grey overcoat and a curly-haired boy in a red quilted jacket could be seen through the glass door on the other side of the street. Holzer crossed himself with his left hand, as he always did, and started to squeeze the trigger on his weapon. But what was happening? The door did not open. The man hesitated and looked down at his mobile.
"Get a move on," Holzer thought. "Here we go."
Slowly, slowly, the door was pushed open, and they were on their way out, and Holzer raised his pistol, aiming at the boy's face through the telescopic sight, and saw once more those glassy eyes. Suddenly he felt an unexpected, violent rush of excitement. Suddenly he did want to kill the boy. Suddenly he wanted to snuff out that frightening look once and for all. But then something happened. A young woman came running out of nowhere and threw herself over the boy as Holzer fired and hit on his target. He hit something, and shot again and again. But the boy and the woman had rolled behind a car, quick as lightning. Holzer caught his breath and looked right and left. Then he raced across the street, commando style. This time he was not going to fail. Linden had never been on satisfactory terms with telephones. His wife Saga leaped with anticipation at every call, hoping that it would bring a new job or a new offer. He felt uncomfortable whenever his mobile rang. It was because of all the complaints. He and the medical center were always taking abuse. In his view, that was part of their business. Odense was an emergency center, and so inevitably emotions tended to run high. But he also knew on some level that the complaints were justified. He may have driven his cost-cutting too far. Occasionally he just ran away, went out to the woods and let the others get on with it. On the other hand, he did from time to time get recognition, most recently from no less a person than Professor Edelman. The professor had irritated him at first. He did not like it when outsiders meddled in the way the clinic managed their procedures, but he felt more conciliatory since he had been praised in that email. Who knows, he might even get the professor to support the idea of the boy staying on at Odin's for a while. That would add some spark to his life, although he could not quite understand why. As a rule, he tended to keep himself apart from the children. There was something enigmatic about this August Balder which intrigued him. From the very first he had been irritated by the police and their demands. He wanted August to himself and hoped perhaps to capture some of the mystique surrounding the boy, or at least to be able to understand what those endless rows of numbers meant, the ones he had written on that comic in the playroom. But it was far from easy. The boy seemed to dislike any form of contact, and now he was refusing to come out to the street. He was being hopelessly contrary, and Linden was forced to drag him along.
"Come on! Come on!"
he muttered. Then his mobile buzzed. Somebody was determined to get hold of him. He did not answer. Probably it was some trivial nonsense, yet another complaint. But as he reached the door, he decided to check his messages. There were several texts from a withheld number, and they were saying something strange, presumably some kind of a joke. They told him not to go outside. He was under no circumstances to go into the street. Incomprehensible. And at that moment August seemed to want to run for it. Linden took a firm grip on his arm, opened the door hesitantly, and pulled the boy out. Everything was normal. People walked by as they did every day, and he wondered again about the text messages. But before he had time to complete the thought, a figure came rushing in from the left and threw itself over the boy. In that instant he heard a shot. Obviously he was in danger. He looked around wildly, and saw a tall, powerful man running towards him across Sveavägen. What the hell did he have in his hand? Was that a pistol? Without a thought for August, Linden turned to go back through the door, and for a second or two he thought he was going to make it to safety. But he never did. Salander's reaction had been instinctive as she launched herself on top of the boy. She had hurt herself when she hit the sidewalk, or at least there was pain in her shoulder and chest, but she had no time to take stock. She took hold of the child and hid behind a car, and they lay there breathing heavily while shots were fired. After that it became disturbingly quiet, and when Salander peered under the car, she could see the sturdy legs of their attacker racing across the street. It crossed her mind to grab the Beretta from her sports bag and return fire, but she realized she would not have time. On the other hand, a large Volvo came crawling past, so she jumped to her feet and in one confused rush lifted the boy and ran towards the car. She wrenched open the back door and threw herself in with him.
"Drive!"
she yelled, as she saw blood spreading onto the seat. Jakob Charo was 22, and the proud owner of a Volvo XC60, which he had bought on credit with his father as guarantor. He was on his way to Uppsala to have lunch with his uncle and aunt and cousins, and he was looking forward to it. He was dying to tell them that he'd gotten a place on Syrian FC's first team. The radio was playing "Wake Me Up" by Avicii, and he was drumming his fingers on the steering wheel as he drove past the concert hall and the Stockholm School of Economics. Something was going on further down the street. People were running in all directions. A man was shouting, and the cars in front of the Volvo were driving erratically, so Charo slowed down. If there had been an accident, he might be able to help. Charo was always dreaming of being a hero. But this time he got a fright. The man to the left of him across the road ran into the traffic, looking like a soldier on an offensive. There was something brutal in his movements, and Charo was about to floor the accelerator when he heard his rear door being yanked open. Someone had thrown themselves in. Charo started shouting. He had no idea what. Maybe it was not even in Swedish, but the person—it was a girl with a child—yelled back.
"Drive!"
He hesitated for a second. Who were these people? Maybe they meant to rob him or steal the car. He could not think straight. The whole situation was crazy. Then he had no choice but to act. His rear window was shattered because someone was shooting at them, so he accelerated wildly and with a pounding heart drove through a red light at the intersection with Odengarten.
"What's all this about?"
he shouted.
"What's going on?"
"Shut it!" the girl snapped back. In the rearview mirror he could see her examining the small boy with large, terrified eyes, checking him over with practiced movements like a hospital nurse. Then he noticed for the first time that there was not just broken glass all over the back seat. There was blood, too.
"Has he been shot?"
"I don't know. Just keep driving.
Go left, there. Now!"
"Okay, okay," he said, terrified. And he took a hard left up along Vanadisvägen and drove at high speed towards Vasastan, wondering if they were being followed and if anyone would shoot at them again. He lowered his head towards the steering wheel and felt the draught through the broken rear window. What the hell had he been dragged into? And who was this girl? He looked at her again in the mirror, black hair and piercings and a glowering look, and for a moment he felt that as far as she was concerned he simply did not exist. But then she muttered something which sounded almost cheerful.
"Good news?"
he asked. She did not answer. Instead she pulled off her leather jacket, took hold of her white T-shirt, and then— Jesus! She ripped it apart with a sudden jerk and was sitting there naked from the waist up, not wearing a bra or anything. And he glanced in bewilderment at her breasts, which stood straight out, and above all at the blood that ran over them like a rivulet, down towards her stomach and the waistband of her jeans. The girl had been hit somewhere below the shoulder, not far above her heart, and was bleeding heavily. Using the T-shirt for a bandage, she wound it tightly to staunch the flow of blood and put her leather jacket back on. She looked ridiculously pleased with herself, especially since some of the blood had splashed onto her cheek and forehead, like war paint. "So the good news is that you got shot and not the boy," he said.
"Something like that," she said. "Shall I take you to the Karolinska Hospital?"
"No." Salander had found both the entry and exit holes. The bullet must have gone straight through the front of her shoulder, which was bleeding profusely. She could feel her heart pounding all the way up to her temples. But she did not think any artery had been severed, or at least so she hoped. She looked back. The attacker must have had a getaway car somewhere close by, but nobody seemed to be following them. With any luck, they had managed to escape fast enough. She quickly looked down at the boy, August, who was sitting with his hands crossed over his chest, rocking backwards and forwards. It struck Salander that she ought to do something, so she brushed the glass fragments from the boy's hair and legs, and that made him sit still for a moment. Salander was not sure that was a good sign. The look in his eyes was rigid and blank. She nodded at him and tried to look as if she had the situation under control. She was feeling sick and dizzy, and the T-shirt she had wound around her shoulder was by now soaked in blood. She was afraid that she might be losing consciousness and tried to come up with some sort of plan. One thing was crystal clear: the police were not an option. They had led the boy right into the path of the assailant and were plainly not on top of the situation, so what should she do? She could not stay in this car. It had been seen at the shooting, and the shattered rear window was bound to attract attention. She should get the man to drive her home to Fiskargatan. Then she could take her BMW, registered to Irene Nesser, if only she had the strength to drive it.
"Head towards Vesterbron," she ordered.
"Okay, okay,"
said the man driving.
"Do you have anything to drink? A bottle of whiskey? I was going to give it to my uncle."
"Pass it back here," she said,
and was handed a bottle of Grant's, which she opened with difficulty. She tore off her makeshift bandage and poured whiskey onto the bullet wound. She took one, two, three big mouthfuls, and was just offering some to August when it dawned on her that that was perhaps not such a good idea. Children don't drink whiskey, not even children in shock. Her thoughts were getting confused. Was that what was happening?
"You'll have to give me your shirt," she said to the man up front.
"What?"
"I need something else to bandage my shoulder with."
"Okay, but no buts. If you want me to help you, you could at least tell me why you were being shot at. Are you criminals?"
"I'm trying to protect the boy. It's that simple. Those bastards were after him."
"Why?" "None of your business. So he's not your son?"
"I don't even know him. So why are you helping him?"
Salander hesitated.
"We have the same enemies," she said.
At that, the young man pulled off his V-necked pullover with a certain amount of reluctance and difficulty as he steered the car with his other hand. Then he unbuttoned his shirt, took it off, and handed it back to Salander, who wound it gingerly around her shoulder. August, who was worryingly immobile now, looked down at his skinny legs with a frozen expression, and once again Salander asked herself what she ought to do. They could hide out at her place on Fiskargatan. Blomqvist was the only person who knew the address, and the apartment could not be traced through her name on any public register. But it was still a risk. There had been a time when she was known up and down the country as a complete lunatic, and this enemy was certainly skilled at digging up information. Someone on Sveavägen might have recognized her. The police might already be turning everything upside down to find her. She needed a new hiding place, not linked to any of her identities, and so she needed help.
But from whom? Holger?
Her former guardian, Holger Palmgren, had almost recovered from his stroke and was living in a two-room apartment on Liljeholmstorget. Holger was the only person who really knew her. He was loyal to a fault and would do everything in his power to help, but he was elderly and anxious, and she did not want to drag him into this if she could help it. There was Blomqvist, of course, and in fact there was nothing wrong with him. Still, she was reluctant to contact him again. perhaps precisely because there was nothing wrong with him. He was such a damn good person. But what the hell? You could hardly hold that against him, or at least not too much. She called his mobile. He picked up after just one ring, sounding alarmed.
It's such a relief to hear your voice. What the hell happened?
I can't tell you now.
It looks like one of you's been shot. There's blood here.
The boy's okay.
And you?
I'm okay.
You've been shot.
You'll have to wait, Blomqvist. She looked out at the town and saw that they were close to Vesterbron already. She turned to the driver.
Pull up there, by the bus stop.
Are you getting out?
You're getting out. You're going to give me your mobile and wait outside while I talk. Is that clear?
He glanced at her, terrified, then passed back his mobile, stopped the car and got out. Salander continued her conversation.
What's going on? Blomqvist said.
Don't you worry about that, she said. From now on, I want you to carry an Android phone with you, a Samsung or something. You must have one at the office.
Yes, I think there are a couple.
Good. So go straight into Google Play and download the Redphone app and also the Threema app for text messaging. We need a secure line of communication.
Right.
If you're as much of an idiot as I think you are, whoever helps you do it has to remain anonymous. I don't want any weak points.
Of course.
And then...
Yes?
Only use it in an emergency. All other communication should be through a special link on your computer. You or the person who isn't an idiot needs to go into www.pgpi.org and download an encryption program for your emails. I want you to do that right now, then I want you to find a safe hiding place for the boy and me, somewhere not connected to you or Millennium, and let me have the address in an encrypted email.
It's not your job to keep the boy safe, Elizabeth.
I don't trust the police.
Then we'll have to find someone else you do trust. The boy is autistic, he has special needs. I don't think you should be responsible for him, especially not if you're wounded.
Are you going to keep talking crap, or do you want to help me?
Help you, of course.
Good. Check Lisbeth's stuff in 5 minutes. I'll give you more information there. Then delete it.
Lisbeth, listen to me. You need to get to a hospital. You need to be fixed up. I can tell by your voice.
She hung up, waved the young man back in from the bus stop, got out her laptop, and through her mobile hacked into Blomqvist's computer. She wrote out instructions on how to download and install the encryption program. She then told the man to drive her to Mosabaka Toruk. It was a risk, but she had no choice. The city was beginning to look more and more blurred. Blomqvist swore under his breath. He was standing on Sveavägen, not far from the body of Torkel Linden, and the cordon which the police who had been first on the scene were putting in place. Ever since Salander's original call, he had been engaged in a frenzy of activity. He had thrown himself into a taxi to get here and had done everything he could during the trip to stop the boy and the director from stepping out onto the street. The only other member of the staff he had managed to get hold of at Orden's medical centre was Birgitta Lindgren, who had rushed into the hallway only to see her colleague fall against the door with a fatal bullet wound to his head. When Blomqvist arrived 10 minutes later, she was beside herself. But she and another woman by the name of Ulrika Franzen, who had been on her way to the offices of Albert Bonniers, the publishers further up the street, had still been able to give Blomqvist a pretty coherent account of what had happened. Which was why Blomqvist knew, even before his mobile rang again, that Salander had saved August Balder's life. She and the boy were now in some car with a driver who had no reason to be enthusiastic about helping them after getting shot at. Blomqvist had seen the blood on the sidewalk and on the street, and even though the call reassured him somewhat, he was still extremely concerned. Salander had sounded in a bad way, and yet, not that it surprised him, she had been as pig-headed as ever. She had a gunshot wound, but she was determined to hide the boy herself. That was understandable, given her history. But should he and the magazine get involved? However heroic her actions on Sveavägen, what she had done might, from a legal point of view, be seen as kidnapping. He could not help her with that. He was already in trouble with the media, as well as the public prosecutor. But this was Salander, after all, and he had given his word. He would damn well help her, even if Beria threw a fit. He took a deep breath and pulled out his mobile, but a familiar voice was calling out behind him. It was Jan Bublansky. Bublansky came running along the sidewalk close to physical collapse, and with him were Detective Sergeant Modig and a tall, athletic man in his 50s, presumably the professor Salander had mentioned.
"Where's the boy?"
Bublansky panted.
"He was whisked away in a big red Volvo. Somebody rescued him."
"Who?"
"I'll tell you what I know,"
Blomqvist said, not sure what he would or should say. But first I have to make a call.
Oh, no, first you're going to talk to us. We have to send out a nationwide alert.
Talk to that lady over there. Her name is Ulrika Franzen. She knows more than I do. She saw it happen. She's even got some sort of description of the assailant. I arrived after it happened.
And the man who saved the boy?
The woman who saved him. Fru Franzen has a description of her as well. But just give me a minute here.
How did you know something was going to happen in the first place?
Modig spat, with unexpected anger.
They said on the radio that you had called the emergency services before any shots were fired.
I had a tip-off.
From whom?
Blomqvist took another deep breath and looked Modig straight in the eye, unmovable as ever. Whatever may have been written in today's papers, I hope you realize that I want to cooperate with you in every way I can.
I've always trusted you, Mika, but I'm beginning to have my doubts, Modig said.
Okay, I understand that, but you have to understand that I don't trust you either. There's been a serious leak. You've grasped that much, haven't you? Otherwise this wouldn't have happened, he said, pointing at the prone body inside the cordon.
That's true, and it's absolutely terrible,
Boblansky said. I'm going to make my call now, Blomqvist said, and he walked up the street so he could talk undisturbed. But he never made the call. He realized that the time had come to get serious about security. So he walked back and informed Boblansky and Modig that he had to go to his office immediately, but he was at their disposal whenever they needed him. At that moment, to her own surprise, Modig took hold of his arm.
First, you have to tell us how you knew that something was going to happen, she said sharply.
I'm afraid I have to invoke my right to protect my sources, Blomqvist answered with a pained smile. Then he waved down a taxi and took off for the office, deep in thought. Millennium used TechSource, a consultancy firm with a team of young women who gave the magazine quick and efficient help whenever they had more complex IT issues. But he did not want to bring them in, nor did he feel like turning to Chris de Malm, even though he knew more about IT than anyone on the editorial team. Instead, he thought of Xander, who was already involved in the story and was also great with computers. Blomqvist decided to ask for his help, and promised himself that he would fight to get the boy a permanent job, provided that he and Beria managed to sort out this mess. Beria's morning had been a nightmare, even before shots were fired on Sveavägen, and that was due to the sickening TT bulletin. To some extent it was a continuation of the old campaign against Blomqvist. All the jealous, twisted souls came crawling out of the woodwork again, spewing their bile on Twitter and online forums and in emails. But this time the racist mob joined in because Millennium had been in the forefront of the battles against xenophobia and racism for many years. The worst part was surely that this hate campaign made it so much more difficult for everyone to do their jobs. All of a sudden, people were less inclined to share information with the magazine. On top of that, there was a rumour that Chief Prosecutor Ekstrom was planning to issue a search warrant for the magazine's offices. Beria did not really believe it. That kind of warrant was a serious matter, given the right to source protection. But she did agree with Christa Malm that the toxic atmosphere would even give lawyers ludicrous ideas about how they should act. She was standing there thinking about how to retaliate when Blomqvist stepped into the offices. To her surprise, he did not want to talk to her. Instead, he went straight to Xander and ushered him into her room. After a while, she followed. She found the young man looking tense. She heard Blomqvist mention PGP. She had taken an IT security course, so she knew what that meant, and she saw Xander making notes before, without so much as a glance in her direction, he made a beeline for Blomqvist's laptop in the open-plan office.
"What was all that about?" she said.
Blomqvist told her in a whisper. She could barely take it in, and he had to repeat himself.
"So you want me to find a hiding place for them?"
"Sorry to drag you into this, Erika," he said, "but I don't know anyone who has as many friends with summer houses as you do."
"I don't know, Mikael. I really don't know."
"We can't let them down. Salander has been shot. The situation is desperate.
If she's been shot, she should go to a hospital."
"She won't. She wants to protect the boy at all costs,
to give him the calm he needs to draw the murderer."
"Yes."
"It's too great a responsibility, Mika. Too great a risk. If something happens, the fallout would destroy the magazine. Witness protection is not our job. This is something for the police. Just think of all the questions that will be thrown up by those drawings, both for the investigation and on a psychological level. There has to be another solution.
Maybe. If we were dealing with someone other than Lisbeth Salander.
You know what? I get really pissed off with the way you always defend her.
I'm only trying to be realistic. The authorities have let the Balder boy down and put his life in danger. I know that infuriates Salander.
So we just have to go along with it, is that it?
We don't have a choice. She's out there somewhere, hopping mad and has nowhere to go.
Take them to Sandhamn, then.
There's too much of a connection between Lisbeth and me. If it comes out that it's her, they would search my address straight away.
Okay, then.
Okay, then what?
Okay, I'll find something.
She could hardly believe she was saying it.
That is how it was with Blomqvist.
She was incapable of saying no. But there was no limit to what he would do for her, either.
Great, Ricky. Where?
She tried to think, but her mind was a blank. She could not come up with a single name.
I'm racking my brains, she said.
Well, do it quickly, then give the address and directions to Andre. He knows what to do.
Beria needed some air, and so she went down onto Jutgarten and walked in the direction of Medborgarplatsen, running through one name after another in her mind.
But not one of them felt right. And there was too much at stake. Everyone she thought of had some drawback, or, even if not, she was reluctant to expose them to the risk or put them to the trouble by asking, perhaps because she herself was so upset by the situation. On the other hand, here was a small boy, and people were trying to kill him, and she had promised. She had to come up with something. A police siren wailed in the distance, and she looked over towards the park and the Tunnelbana station and at the mosque on the hill. A young man went by, surreptitiously shuffling some papers, and then suddenly, Gabriella Grana. At first, the name surprised her. Grana was not a close friend, and she worked at a place where it was unwise to flout any laws. Grana would risk losing her job if she so much as got near this, and yet, Beria could not get the idea out of her head. It was not just that Grana was an exceptionally good and responsible person. A memory also kept intruding. It was from the summer, in the early hours of the morning, or maybe even at daybreak, after a crayfish party out at Grana's summer house on Ingaru Island, when the two had been sitting in a garden swing on the terrace, looking down at the water through a gap in the trees.
"This is where I'd run to, if the hyenas were after me,"
Beria had said, without really knowing what she meant. She had been feeling tired and vulnerable at work, and there was something about that house which she thought would make it an ideal place of refuge. It stood on a rock promontory with steep, smooth sides, and was shielded from onlookers by the surrounding trees and elevation. She remembered Grana replying,
"If the hyenas come after you, you're welcome to hide here, Erica."
Maybe it was asking too much, but she decided to give it a try. She went back to the office to call from the encrypted red phone app, which Xander had by then installed for her too.
Chapter 18 November 22nd Gabriella Grana was on her way to a meeting at Seppo when her personal mobile buzzed. The meeting had been called at very short notice to discuss the incident at Sveavägen. She answered tersely.
"Yes? It's Erica. Hi there. Can't talk now. We'll speak later. I have a..."
Beria said. But Grana had already hung up. This was no time for personal calls. She walked into the meeting room, wearing an expression that suggested she meant to start a minor war. Crucial information had been leaked, and now a second person was dead, and one more apparently seriously wounded. She had never felt more like telling the whole lot of them to go to hell. They had been so eager to get hold of new information that they had lost their heads. For half a minute she did not hear one word her colleagues were saying. She just sat there, seething. But then she pricked up her ears. Someone was saying that Mikael Blomqvist, the journalist, had called the emergency services before shots were fired on Sveavägen. That was strange. And now Erica Beria had called, and she was not the type to make casual calls, certainly not during working hours. She may have had something important or even critical to say. Grana got up and made an excuse.
"Gabriella, you need to listen to this," Kraft said, in an unusually sharp tone. "I have to take a call," she replied.
and suddenly she was not in the least interested in what the head of the security police thought of her.
"What sort of call?"
"A call," she said, and left them to go into her office. Beria at once asked Grana to call her instead on the Samsung. The minute she had her friend on the line again, she could tell that something was going on. There was none of the usual warm enthusiasm in her voice. On the contrary, Grana sounded worried and tense, as if she knew from the start that the conversation was important.
"Hi,"
she said simply. "I'm still really pushed, but is it about August Balder?" Beria felt acutely uncomfortable.
"How did you know?"
"I'm on the investigation, and I've just heard that Mikael Blomqvist was tipped off about what was going to happen on Sveavägen."
"You've already heard that?"
"Yes, and now, of course, we're eager to know how that came about."
"Sorry, I can't tell you."
"Okay, understood.
But why did you call?"
Beria closed her eyes. How could she have been such an idiot?
"I'm so sorry. I'll have to ask somebody else," she said. "You have a conflict of interest."
"I'm happy to take on almost any conflict of interest, Erica, but I can't stand your withholding information. This investigation means more to me than you can imagine."
"Really?"
"Yes, it does. I knew that Balder was under serious threat, yet I still couldn't prevent the murder, and I'm going to have to live with that for the rest of my life. So please, don't hide anything from me."
"I'm going to have to, Gabriella. I'm sorry. I don't want you to get into trouble because of us."
"I saw Mikael in Saltsjöbaden the night before last, the night of the murder."
"He didn't mention that?"
"It wouldn't have made sense to identify myself."
"I understand.
We could help each other out in this mess."
"That sounds like a good idea. I can ask Mikael to call you later, but now I have to get on with this. I know just as well as you do that there's a leak in the police team. At this stage we could benefit from unlikely alliances."
"Absolutely. But I'm sorry. I have to press on."
"Okay,"
Grana said, obviously disappointed. "I'll pretend this call never happened. Good luck now."
"Thanks,"
Beria said, and went back to searching through her contacts. Grana went back to the meeting room, her mind whirling. What was it that Erica had wanted? She did not fully understand, and yet she had a vague idea. As she came back into the room, the conversation died, and everyone looked at her.
"What was that about?"
Kraft said.
"Something private.
That you have to deal with now?"
"That I had to deal with. How far have you gotten?"
"We were talking about what happened on Sveavägen,"
said Ragnar Olofsson, the head of the division.
"But as I was saying, we don't yet have enough information. The situation is chaotic, and it looks as if we're losing our source in Boblansky's group. The detective inspector has become paranoid."
"You can't blame him,"
Grana said.
"Well, perhaps not. We've talked about that, too. We leave no stone unturned until we know how the attacker figured out that the boy was at the medical center and that he was going to go out by the front door when he did. No effort will be spared, I need hardly say. But I must emphasize that the leak did not necessarily come from within the police. The information was quite widely known. At the medical center, of course, by the mother and her unreliable partner, Lasse Westman, and in the offices of Millennium. And we can't rule out hacker attacks. I'll come back to that. If I might continue with my report?"
"Please."
"We've been discussing how Mikael Blomqvist comes into all this, and this is where we're worried. How could he know about a shooting before it happens? In my opinion, he's got some source close to the criminals themselves, and I see no reason for us to tiptoe around his efforts to protect those sources. We have to find out where he got his information from."
"The more so since he seems desperate and will do anything for a scoop," Superintendent Morten Nielsen added.
"It would appear that Morten has some excellent sources, too. He reads the evening papers,"
Grana said acidly.
"Not the evening papers, sweetie. TT, a source which even we at SEPO regard as fairly reliable."
"That was defamatory, and you know it as well as I do,"
Grana hissed.
"I had no idea you were so besotted with Blomqvist."
"Idiot!"
"Stop it at once," Kraft said. "This is ridiculous behavior. Carry on, Ragnar. What do we know about what happened?" "The first people on the scene were two regular police officers, Erik Sandström and Tord Landgren," Olofsson said. "My information comes from them. They were there on the dot of 9:24, and by then it was all over. Torkel Lindén was dead, shot in the back of the head. And the boy, well, we don't know. According to witnesses, he was hit too.
We have blood in the street, but nothing is confirmed. The boy was driven away in a red Volvo. We do at least have parts of the registration number, plus the model of the vehicle. I anticipate that we'll get the name of its owner pretty soon."
Grana noticed that Kraft was writing everything down, just as she had done at their earlier meetings.
"But what actually happened?" she asked.
"According to two students from the School of Economics, who were standing on the opposite side of Sverfagen, it looked like a settling of scores between two criminal gangs who were both after the boy."
"Sounds far-fetched."
"I'm not so sure," Olofsson said.
"What makes you say that?" Kraft said.
"There were professionals on both sides. The assailant seems to have been standing and watching the door from a low green wall on the other side of Sverfagen, in front of the park. There's a lot to suggest that he's the man who shot Franz Balder. Not that anyone has seen his face. It's possible he was wearing some sort of mask, but he seems to have moved with the same remarkable efficiency and speed. And in the opposite camp, there was this woman."
"What do we know about her?"
"Not much. She was wearing a black leather jacket, we think, and dark jeans. She was young, with black hair and piercings, a punk, according to one witness, also short but fierce. She appeared out of nowhere and shielded the boy with her body. The witnesses all agree that she was not some ordinary member of the public. She seemed to have training, or had at least found herself in similar situations before. Then there's the car. We have conflicting reports. One witness says it just happened to be driving by, and the woman and the boy threw themselves in more or less while it was moving. Others, especially those guys from the School of Economics, think the car was part of the operation. Either way, I'm afraid we have a kidnapping on our hands."
"It doesn't make sense. This woman saved the boy only to abscond with him?"
Grana said. "That's what it looks like. Otherwise we would have heard from her by now, wouldn't we?"
"How did she get to Sverfagen?"
"We don't know yet, but a witness, a former editor-in-chief of a trade union paper, says the woman looked somehow familiar," Olofsson said. He went on to say something else, but by then Grana had stopped listening. She was thinking,
Zalachenko's daughter. It has to be Zalachenko's daughter,
knowing full well how unfair it was to call her that. The daughter had nothing to do with the father. On the contrary, she had hated him, but Grana had known her by that name ever since, years earlier. She had read everything she could lay her hands on about the Zalachenko affair. While Olofsson continued speculating, she began to feel the pieces falling into place. Already the day before she had identified some commonalities between Zalachenko's old network and the group which called itself the Spiders, but had dismissed them. She had believed there was a limit to how far thuggish criminals could develop their skills. It seemed entirely unreasonable to suppose that they could go from seedy-looking biker types in leather vests to cutting-edge hackers. Yet the thought had occurred to her. Grana had even wondered if the girl who helped Linus Brandel trace the break-in on Balder's computers might have been Zalachenko's daughter. There was a Seppo file on the woman, with a note that said, "Hacker? Computer savvy?" And even though it seemed prompted by the surprisingly favourable reference she had received for her work at Milton Security, it was clear from the document that she had devoted a great deal of time to research into her father's criminal organisation. Most striking of all was that there was a known connection between the woman and Mikael Blomqvist. It was unclear what exactly that connection was. Grana did not for one moment believe the malicious rumours that it was sadomasochistic sex, but the connection was there. Both Blomqvist and the woman who matched the description of Zalachenko's daughter appeared to have known something about the shooting on Sverfagen beforehand, and afterwards Erika Berger had rung to discuss something important. Wasn't it all pointing in the same direction?
"I was wondering," Grana said, perhaps too loudly, interrupting Olofsson.
"Yes," he said testily. She was about to present her theory when she noticed something which made her hesitate. It was nothing remarkable, just that Kraft was once again meticulously writing down what Olofsson had said. It was probably good to have a senior boss who was so committed, but there was something rather too zealous about that scratching pen, and it made Grana wonder why that senior boss, whose job it was to see the bigger picture, should be preoccupied with every tiny detail. Without really knowing why, Grana began to feel very uneasy. It may have been because she was formulating suspicion on flimsy grounds. Then Kraft realized that she was being observed and looked away in embarrassment. It looked like she was blushing. Grana decided not to finish the sentence she had begun.
or rather...
Yes, Gabriella, Olufsen prompted.
Oh, nothing, she said, feeling a sudden need to get away.
Even though she knew it would not look good, she left the meeting room once more and went to the toilet. Later she would remember how she stared at herself.